Yes, we can see your slides and we can see you up at the top.
Hello, friends. Welcome to this 58th webinar on the Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series is available on Makara.us under the subheading Moria Federation, and then Webinar Series in Progress. Previous episodes of this, the Secret Doctrine, and a Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars on the homepage of MoriaFederation.com. It shows up here in the upper left-hand corner. Okay. Last time we finished the subsection called Solar Colors, where we learned about the significance of red, blue, yellow, and orange in color therapy, their symbolic use by ancient cultures, and their spiritual significance in DK's teachings. We then took a look at the use of liturgical colors used both in stained glass windows and paintings depicting the saints. This concluded an eight-part webinar series on the sun, a universal deity. We now turn the page, of the folio edition. We come to a new chapter entitled The Zodiac and Its Signs. So we'll start by looking at the chapter's frontispiece, which depicts an outer tier of throned constellational lords, lords of the signs, and an inner group of 10 white-robed figures, representing the three aspects of the sun and seven of the planetary logoi, all facing a flaming altar circumscribed by a golden triangle. So let's start by reading the text that appears under the illustration. Can we get a reader, please?
I'll start us off. In the midst of cosmos stands the fiery altar of divinity, its most familiar analog being the life germ in an egg. Three holy powers, the triune aspect of the central one, represented as aged men with flames on their heads, continually adore their own source and bear witness of it before creation. Seven venerable governors, each bearing a staff surmounted by the symbol of his power, stand in a circle around the golden triangle. At the circumference of the egg sit 12 aged kings, whose thrones are zodiacal constellations and who constitute hypothetical faces of the universal dodecahedron. The four fixed signs of the zodiac, Taurus, Leo, Scorpio, and Aquarius, are shown as the arms of a great St. Andrew's cross. Upon this cross, the solar man is annually crucified and by his death enters the grave of creation, that he may thereby redeem the creatures dwelling within the shell of the world egg. The signs of the zodiac are shown according to the mystic arrangement of Jacob Bohm. Their fiery altar is elevated upon three steps to signify that the third world is the power dwelling place of the first laws. The three figures with the flames upon their head may be likened to the mother letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The seven figures holding staves to the double letters and the 12 seated kings to the simple letters. Herein is set forth the ancient concept of the hierarchies governing the destiny of the world egg and its contents and various figures being personifications of universal agencies.
Thank you, BL. Okay, so before we get started, just want to remind you that these webinars are always more interesting when when we get a dialogue going. So if you have any thoughts or questions at any point, please raise your hand and share with us. Okay, so first up, in the midst of cosmos stands the fiery altar of divinity, its most familiar analog being the life germ in an egg. So MPH gives us a universal statement, but the illustration itself clearly depicts our solar system with the sun at its center. For a clear understanding of the universal germ in the egg, we'll turn to the first page of the poem of the Secret Doctrine. Could we get a reader, please?
Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
The point in the hitherto immaculate disk, space and eternity in Pralaya, denotes the dawn of differentiation. It is the point in the mundane egg, the germ within the latter, which will become the universe, the all, the boundless, periodical cosmos. This germ being latent and active, periodically and by turns. The one circle is divine unity from which all proceeds, whither all returns. Its circumference, a forcibly limited symbol in view of the limitation of the human mind, indicates the abstract, ever incognizable presence, and its plane, the universal soul, although the two are one.
Okay, thank you, Vivian. Any thoughts or questions about this? This is one of the, yeah.
Oops, sorry. I think you'll probably get to it, but Anne Veronica says dodecahedron, the platonic solid that represents the universe.
Yeah, and how appropriate coming from a Greek, since it's the, the Platonist who really suggested the importance of these Platonic solids, hence the name. Yeah. Okay. So, if there's no more questions about this, we'll go ahead. Next, three holy powers, the triune aspect of the central one. Represented as aged men with flames on their heads, continually adore their own source and bear witness of it before creation. So here they are, the three holy men. Holy powers, actually, they're not, neither men nor women, are the first, second, and third logoi, the Father, Mother, or Holy Spirit, and Son aspects of divinity, as shown in this chart from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. This trinity is also associated with the three principles of Jacob Boehm, which we'll take a look at in a minute. Next, seven venerable governors, each bearing a staff surmounted by the symbol of his power, stand in a circle about the golden triangle. So the staffs of the seven governors reveal them to be the planetary logoi of Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, with no representation for Vulcan, Earth, or Pluto. So it's really just the planets starting with Mercury and going out and skipping Earth and going out to and including Neptune. So it's not the seven sacred planets, it's not the seven planets of the ancients, but a, again, we don't know just how much control Manly P. Hall had over J.A. Knapp's illustrations, but it is what it is. Next, at the circumference of the egg, sit 12 aged kings whose thrones are zodiacal constellations and who constitute the hypothetical faces of the universal dodecahedron. Here's a geocentric chart depicting the interrelationship between the four elements, the ecliptic, equinoxes, and solstices, the four crosses, alternating symbols of Mars and Venus, the exoteric rulers of Aries and Taurus, and finally the signs. On the right, it's a dodecahedron with the zodiacal signs depicted on each face, which was created as a result of a comment made by Plato in his book Phaedo. In it, Plato says that the world, if seen from above, would look like a ball covered with 12 differently colored pieces of leather. The Pythagoreans recognized the importance of what came to be called the Platonic solids, including the regular dodecahedron, which for them was a symbol of the universe in full manifestation. In fact, at one time, it was actually considered to be a secret. The existence of the dodecahedron was one of the mysteries of initiation, at least into the Greek mystery schools. Okay, next, the four fixed signs of the zodiac, Taurus, Leo, Scorpio, and Aquarius, are shown as the arms of the great Saint Andrew's cross. Upon this cross, the solar man is annually crucified, and by his death enters the grave of creation, that he may thereby redeem the creatures dwelling within the shell of the world egg. So indeed, the light, love, and power of the solar logos redeems the creatures dwelling within his ring pass knot, which is the quote unquote shell of his ring pass knot or world egg. The fixed cross, shown in a cream color on the left, is here given the name St. Andrew's cross in honor of the saint who was crucified on an X-shaped cross. The solar man's annual crucifixion on the fixed cross occurred during the age of Taurus, when that cross marked the solstices and equinoxes. At that time, the sun's quote unquote death occurred at the winter solstice in Aquarius. For the disciple, the fixed cross marks that influence that will lead to the death of the personality. Okay, thoughts or questions? Next up, the signs of the zodiac are shown according to the mystic arrangement of Jacob Boehm. This mystic arrangement puts Aries, shown here, in the upper left quadrant with passage through the signs progressing clockwise. The chart also articulates Jacob Boehm's three principles. The light principle, representing love and the presence of God. The dark principle, representing wrath or the absence of God. Chaos is what it's called in theosophy. And the mixed world, which embodies the human experience of these opposing forces. In Boehm's philosophy, each sign represents an admixture of and relations between these three principles, really between the two, between the light and the dark principles. Next, the fiery altar is elevated upon three steps to signify that the third world is the proper dwelling place of the first cause. It's like the first aspect in theosophy. We have the third principle or aspect as being the form, the second as the soul, and the first as the dwelling place of the first cause, or the aspect of deity, spirit. Masons also employed these three steps. This is in line with the three theosophical principles of matter, soul, and deity, the latter represented by a G in Masonry and by a Yod in Kabbalistic thought. Next, the three figures, the flames upon their heads, may be likened to the mother letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The seven figures holding staves to the double letters, and the 12 seated kings to the simple letters. So the three mother letters shown here in Hebrew are Aleph, the spirit aspect, Mem, or soul, and Shin, the matter aspect, which correlates to the three rays of aspect, as well as Bohm's three principles. The seven double letters are Beth, Gimel, Daleth, Kaf, Peh, Resh, and Tau, which in PH associates with the seven planetary logoi. But as shown on the chart, these associations are with the classical seven planets, not with the planets shown in J.A. Knapp's illustration. To complete the Hebrew alphabet, we have the 12 simple letters, which are associated with the 12 zodiacal constellations. And finally, MPH's concluding paragraph emphasizes the universality of these agencies. Quote, "Herein is set forth the ancient concept of the hierarchies governing the destiny of the world egg and its contents, and various figures being personifications of universal agencies." So it's really more the destiny of the solar systemic egg, the ring pass knot of the solar system, that is ruled and controlled by these different agencies. Okay, any thoughts or questions on this illustration or on the commentary?
I don't see anything at this time.
Yeah. Okay, pretty straightforward. Okay. Next up, we'll start a new chapter entitled The Zodiac and Its Signs. So can we get a reader for the first two paragraphs?
Yes. Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. It is difficult for this age to estimate correctly the profound effect produced upon the religions, philosophies, and sciences of antiquity by the study of the planets, luminaries, and constellations. Not without adequate reason were the Magi of Persia called the stargazers. The Egyptians were honored with a special appellation because of their proficiency in computing the power and motion of the heavenly bodies and their effect upon the destinies of nations and individuals. Ruins of primitive astronomical observatories have been discovered in all parts of the world, although in many cases, modern archaeologists are unaware of the true purpose for which these structures were erected. While the telescope was unknown to ancient astronomers, they made many remarkable calculations with instruments cut from blocks of granite or pounded from sheets of brass and copper. In India, such instruments are still in use, and they possess a high degree of accuracy. In Jaipur, Rajputana, India, an observatory consisting largely of immense stone sundials is still in operation. The famous Chinese observatory on the wall of Peking consists of immense bronze instruments, including a telescope in the form of a hollow tube without lenses.
Thank you, Martha.
Francis, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Yes, I was just going along there. Okay, sorry, guys. Okay, so first up, it is difficult for this age to estimate correctly the profound effect produced upon the religions, philosophies, and sciences of antiquity by the study of the planets, luminaries, and constellations. So, as does modern theosophy, practically all ancient cultures viewed celestial bodies as deities. Astrology provided a way, you know, ancient astrology provided a way to interpret the will of the gods. That was its main purpose, often associated with specific planets by studying the movement and positions of these heavenly entities. This practice was deeply embedded in the religious rituals and temples of the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, and Mesopotamians, as well as the Indians. In addition, the philosophers of the time, including the Platonic, Aristotelian, and Stoic schools, often incorporated the cosmos into their systems of thought. As in modern theosophy, they believed in a universe wherein everything is energetically interconnected, alive and interconnected. And with the ancients, this celestial order was believed to be directly responsible for the moral and ethical order on Earth. In the realm of science, astrology was a driving force behind advancements in astronomy and astrology. Observations made for astrological purposes, which sought to explain the influence of celestial bodies on Earth, led to the development of more sophisticated calendars, mathematical models, and an understanding of celestial mechanics. It's pretty much impossible for us to imagine the impact astrology had on the ancients, because modern society has completely separated astrology from mainstream religion, philosophy, and science. But in ancient times, these fields were deeply interconnected, and astrology played a crucial role in shaping the worldview of the civilizations of those times. Saw a hand?
Yes, Joe, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I haven't been attending this class, so I don't know if this author is taking into account the roundness. I'm not doing well with this. In other words, I keep thinking about the flat earth and wondering at what point people began to understand that we were looking at 360 degrees.
Well, the Egyptians knew it. It was lost in the what was called the Dark Ages. Early European culture lost that understanding, but there's no reference in Greek writings to a round world, but since they were, you know, they were basically very connected to the Egyptian school of thought in terms of what was believed, and there were experiments made in Egyptian times that proved that the world was round, and the pyramids certainly the way it was constructed and the axes absolutely confirms that the Egyptians knew that the world was round. So my guess is that the ancient world knew that it was round and that that was lost during the Egyptian culture time. So when astrology was developed, at least you could say redeveloped in the Aryan age, the Aryan race, for the Aryan race, that it was initially developed with a full understanding that that it was that the world was, our world was round. Okay, anyone else? Okay. Okay, could let's see here. So next up, not without adequate reason were the Magi of Persia called the stargazers. These stargazers, who were both astronomers and astrologers, were foremost in their field among the ancients. Everybody knew about them and everybody respected them. They came from a long tradition of Mesopotamian and Persian priestly scholars who were incredibly influential, often advising kings and nobles on a proper course of action based on their celestial observations. Could we get a reader for this, please?
Yes. And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Nor should any objections be raised because we say that alchemy is intimately aligned with magic and astrology. The word magic is an old Persian term which means knowledge and embraces all the sciences, both physical and metaphysical, studied in those days. The sacerdotal, did I say it well? And
yes.
Learned classes of the Chaldeans taught magic, from which came magism and Gnosticism. Was not Abraham called as a Chaldean? And it is Joseph, a pious Jew who, speaking on the Patria, says that he taught mathematics or the esoteric science in Egypt, including the science of the stars, a professor of magism, being of necessity and astrologer.
Thank you, Anne Veronica.
Sorry, I butchered that.
No, not so bad. Okay. Next up, the Egyptians were honored with a special appellation because of their proficiency in computing the power and motion of the heavenly bodies and their effect upon the destinies of nations and the individuals. So not only the Mesopotamians, the Egyptians also had were recognized for their astrological priests. In ancient times, the Egyptians were regarded by other civilizations as the custodians of celestial secrets and were credited with the discovery of astrology. Of course, you know, in truth, I would guess that the astrology actually was certainly alive in the times of Atlantis, at least. And so it would have been brought across after the deluge by those who survived and set up civilization for the fifth root race. The priests at the temple of Hathor at Dendera and at the temple of Amun-Ra or Re at Karnak were the leading astronomer astrologers of the ancient world. Thus, their interpretations of celestial events had a direct impact on the statecraft of Egypt, as well as the destiny of Egyptian royalty. So, you know, again, it's really hard for us to even imagine how deep-seated and how respected this science was. And it was in truth at a level of, these astrologers were at a level of awareness, many of them being initiates, that has been lost, basically. You know, so the advice given, for instance, to the pharaohs and to the high priests really would have been what you might call divinely inspired, you know, truth. And for the most part, I mean, we know that science exists through books like Esoteric Astrology, but in terms of practical astrology, that's largely a lost science. Here are two Egyptian astronomical instruments and a frieze depicting Egyptian deities that are related to the stars. In fact, it's right here. You see it up. Well, no, that's not it. But oh, here it is. Over here, I think. Yeah, that exists on the roof of the temple at Hathor. Okay. So next up, ruins of primitive astronomical observatories have been discovered in all parts of the world, although in many cases, modern archaeologists are unaware of the true purpose for which these structures were erected. So here are two ancient observatories from India and a Chinese observatory built in 1276. Next. While the telescope was unknown to ancient astronomers, they made many remarkable calculations with instruments cut from blocks of granite or pounded from sheets of brass and copper. One of the most accurate of these ancient instruments was Al-Ghujandi's mural sextant. Can we get a reader for this description?
Ben, can you read that for us, please?
The mural was built on a 60-degree arc between two interior walls of a building, measuring about 43 meters, 140 feet in diameter. The arc was sliced into degrees. Each degree was then divided into 360 parts, making the mural not only an incredibly precise solar calendar, but also the first device capable of accurate measurement on such a small scale. Between the summer and winter solstices, the sun moves 47 degrees in the sky. Al-Ghujandi's arc room was topped with a domed ceiling that had a hole to allow the sun's rays to strike the arc. His calculations then allowed him to trace the movement of the sun and to determine the latitude.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Okay, on the other side of the world is Chichen Itza Observatory. Could we get a reader for this?
Person, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Chichen Itza was settled sometime between 415 AD and 455 AD. Its strangely shaped observatory is something of an oddity. While most astronomical instruments were attuned to the movement of the stars or the worship of the sun, El Kara Kol, the snail was focused on the movements of Venus. The planet's pattern of appearance and disappearance caused some problems for astronomers for a long time. For the Maya, Venus was sacred. Everything from festivals to sacrifices was scheduled around the movement of the planet. Wars were even planned to start at the same time that Venus rose in the sky. The planet was a sign of good fortune, with coronations held as Venus made its appearance. Even games were scheduled according to Venus. El Kara Sol was built in the part as a temple to the god Quetzalcoatl, and in part to track the movements of the mysterious planet Venus. Platforms and windows were constructed in positions specific to the movement of Venus, thought to tie into the worship of Quetzalcoatl and the changing of the seasons. Even the massive staircase that leads to the observatory was built with Venus in mind, as the staircase traces the planet's northernmost position.
Thank you. Okay, so something that's not mentioned here is that, you know, Quetzalcoatl was a second ray avatar. Of course, a number of avatars, you know, including our planetary logos, have a deep connection with Venus. So it's no mistake, you know, that this Quetzalcoatl and this observatory to Venus coexisted. Okay, and we have one more. Chanquilo Astronomical Complex in Peru. Could we get a reader for this? Notice these little mounds here. That's, they discovered at some point, was actually a very accurate observatory. Could we get a reader?
Joe, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The Chanquilo Astronomical Site in Peru is so complex that we only discovered its true function in 2007 with the help of a computer program designed to align solar panels, stretching 300 meters, 980 feet, along the hilltop. The site is made up of 13 towers arranged in a straight line. As a fort, it was an incredibly poor choice of location without defensive benefits, access to running water, or a food source. When archaeologists realized that one of the towers lined up with the sunrise on the summer solstice and another with the sunrise on the winter solstice, they began to suspect its true purpose. Built about 2,300 years ago, the towers are the oldest solar observatory in the Americas. There are also separate viewing positions to the east and west of the towers that let someone see where the sun is rising or setting along the complex, even though the sun's path has shifted a fraction of a degree since the observatory was in use. This calendar can still determine the day of the year within a two-day margin of error. Sadly, the massive solar calendar of Chanquilo is the only trace of its builder's civilization. Although it appears that they passed their astronomical knowledge to the Inca, we know nothing else about this South American culture that predated the Inca by more than 1,000 years. A similar site attributed to the Inca has been found near Lake Titicaca and has helped archaeologists trace the evolution of centuries of sun worship.
Thank you, Joe. So, yeah, fascinating. And it also reminds us that, you know, we don't know all the great cultures that have come and gone, you know, that those ones that are historically, you know, through archaeology, we came to know various cultures around the world, but that there are many. I know in India, there are also buildings that predate the earliest known, you know, Indian civilizations, and they have no idea what the culture was that built those. So we have a very circumscribed understanding of what's come before us, historically speaking. Okay, yes, Joe, I see your hand.
Well, I just feel I should tell you that in about 2003 or four, somewhere in there, I visited for a weekend a site in Nevada where Indians in 1200 AD were sitting in the rocks, focusing on the point where the winter solstice occurred and where the summer solstice, did I get that right? Equinoxes occurred.
The solstice,
In other words, all I'm saying is that cultures have been doing this for centuries.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah, a good example of that, of this idea that, you know, we don't know the cultures that came before is that dragon mound that has seven coils that has been dated to something like 12,000 BC. And has asked, I don't remember exactly what astronomical information it collected, but almost certainly the two solstices, since this is seems to be like in Stonehenge, for instance, this was key to the purpose of the site. I saw a hand. Yay, two hands.
Joe, your hand is up again.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that there are 13 mounds there, and that makes me think of the moon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And the other one?
Trudy, please go ahead.
Yeah, I also was thinking about the 13 mounds must relate to the 13 moon calendar of 28 days per year.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, 28 days per month.
Right. Yeah, there is a actually we get into that here, you know, this idea of the 13 and the lunar calendar and how the ancients, you know, because some of the ancients did use lunar calendars. Mesopotamians did. I have an illustration of a Mesopotamian lunar calendar. So, yeah, it's very possible that that was one of the purposes of those 13 mounds. Anyone else?
Catherine says, so fascinating. I've never heard of this site.
I hadn't either. You know, this particular one, I'd heard of the others, but not this one, you know. Probably really in the middle of nowhere. Okay. Okay, so back to the text. In India, such instruments are still in use, and they possess a high degree of accuracy. In Jaipur, Rajputana, India, an observatory consisting largely of immense stone dials is still in operation. So here are two shots of the observatory in Jaipur, which is called Jantar Mantar, or Yantar Mantar. And you can see the big sundial that MPH is talking about here. Next, the famous Chinese observatory on the wall of Peking consists of immense bronze instruments, including a telescope in the form of a hollow tube without lenses. So I couldn't find a photo of the telescope, but here are some of the other instruments in this ancient Peking observatory that MPH describes. And of course, you know, this is not at all an exhaustive list. In fact, it barely scratches the surface, you know, when we're looking at these various observatories and holy sites that were oriented towards astronomy. You know, for instance, the Great Pyramid is probably the most accurate and still the most accurate indicator of the solstices, the equinox, and other astronomical phenomena. And Stonehenge is also one of those extraordinary sites. And I'm sure there are literally hundreds and around the world that in ancient times recorded these events. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Ariane, can you read that for us, please? She's not unmuting. So that Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The pagans looked upon the stars as living things capable of influencing the destinies of individuals, nations, and races. That the early Jewish patriarchs believed that the celestial bodies participated in the affairs of men is evident to any student of biblical literature, as, for example, in the book of Judges, quote, they fought from heaven, even the stars in their courses fought against Sisera. The Chaldeans, Phoenicians, Egyptians, Persians, Hindus, and Chinese all had zodiacs that were much alike in general character, and different authorities have credited each of these nations with being the cradle of astrology and astronomy. The Central and North American Indians also had an understanding of the zodiac, but the patterns and numbers of the signs differed in many details from those of the Eastern Hemisphere. The word zodiac is derived from the Greek zodiacos, which means a circle of animals, or, as some believe, little animals. It is the name given by the old pagan astronomers to a band of fixed stars about 16 degrees wide, apparently encircling the Earth. Robert Hewitt Brown, 32 degrees, states that the Greek word zodiacos comes from zoon, meaning an animal. He adds this latter word is compounded directly from the primitive Egyptian radicals zo, life, and on, a being.
Thank you. So first, the pagans looked upon the stars as living things capable of influencing the destinies of individuals, nations, and races. So among the ancients, stars were seen as part of a larger cosmic tapestry, with each star playing a role in the unfolding narrative of the universe. Fixed stars, in particular, were considered especially potent, often associated with specific deities, myths, and symbols within various cultures. A prime example is the star Sirius, known as Soapdent in ancient Egypt, which played a significant role in Egyptian astronomy and calendar systems because its heliacal rising signaled the impending annual flood of the Nile and the start of the new year. Next. That the early Jewish patriarchs believed that the celestial bodies participated in the affairs of men is evident to any student of biblical literature, as, for example, in the book of Judges, quote, they fought from heaven, even the stars in their courses fought against Sisera. So Judges 5:20 is part of the Song of Deborah, a victory hymn that celebrates the defeat of the Canaanite commander Sisera by the Israelite forces, as shown here. There are many other examples from the Bible indicating how celestial bodies influenced events, such as in Joshua 10, verse 12 and 13, which states, On the day of the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, sun, stand still over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley of Aijalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jashar. Next, the Chaldeans, Phoenicians, Egyptians, Persians, Hindus, and Chinese all had zodiacs that were much alike in general character, and different authorities have credited each of these nations with being the cradle of astrology and astronomy. So Chaldean astrology wedded spirituality with numerology. Still famous today. HPB quotes Chaldean astrology all the time. For example, Chaldean astronomer priests assigned, this is really amazing, they assigned vibrational values to letters based on their sounds which they believed brought to life the spiritual significance of the numbers related to those sounds. These were then used to interpret the influence of celestial bodies on individual lives. Yeah, now there's a very esoteric system that has long been lost, at least on the outer levels. So I'm sure that initiates are aware of these quote unquote vibrational values to letters. As discussed in a previous webinar, the signs of the Egyptian zodiac are named after gods and goddesses, except for one sign called the Nile. Unique to the Egyptian system was the fact that the zodiacal signs were broken into two, three, and in one case, four segments. For example, the sign ruled by Isis lasted from March 11th through the 31st, October 18th through the 29th, and finally, December 19th through the 31st. Persian priests wrote several important astrological texts that are still extant, such as, quote, on the solar equation, quote, on transits, and quote, on the astrolabe. These works demonstrate an incredibly advanced understanding of celestial movements and their effects on earthly matters, because in those days, astronomy and astrology were not separate. You could say astronomy's prime purpose was to make more accurate astrological philosophy and predictions. Hindu astrology is as old as Egyptian astrology and was established by those who immigrated from Atlantis after the deluge to establish the fifth root race. Many ancient Indian temples served dual purposes as place of worship and as observatories. Ancient texts such as the Surya Siddhanta describe sophisticated astronomical calculations and serve as key references for Vedic astrologers. These texts date back to the 4th century, but are believed to be based on much older traditions. The Chinese zodiac, known as Xingziao, is based on a 12-year cycle, with each year represented by an animal sign. These signs are rat, ox, tiger, rabbit, dragon, snake, horse, goat, monkey, rooster, dog, and pig. In addition to the animal signs, Chinese astrology also incorporates the Wu Xing, or five elements: wood, fire, earth, metal, and water. Each element is associated with different zodiacal signs and can influence personality traits and destiny. And by the way, we are currently in the year of the dragon, a symbol of strength, luck, and vitality, and will be under its influence until early next year. Okay, next. I see hands. Great.
Joe, go ahead, please.
Just wanted to say that Jupiter has a 12-year cycle to go around the 360 degrees, mm-hmm. and Chinese zodiac is based on Jupiter.
Isn't that incredible? Yeah. That's as incredible as that observatory in Chichen Itza that is based on the observation of Venus. Thanks, Joe. Next. Next hand.
Oops, sorry. Shriyanta Shanti, please go ahead.
Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, can you hear me? I was with an avatar in India a few times, and he said Sri Shakti Amma, and he's also confirmed the Vedic information that all the gods and goddesses that are worshipped are representative of astrology and astronomy, but I think also across, and I hope this is a correct memory, across 17 universes.
That'd be interesting to hear more about that, just what's meant by universe in that case. A lot of times a universe is actually means a solar systemic life, but yeah, thank you for that.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone
and
else?
Then, yes, Marianne, can you go ahead?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Just a few thoughts about astrology and how all these ways of thinking come together. So when we think of the gods, the Indian gods, as energies, Shiva, Brahma, Vishnu, then we're close to the truth about what is God, and also the rays and how they're influencing us. And I've been thinking recently about how the masters of wisdom who are working with the plan, these are real beings working now, that they must work with the planets. The planets in our solar system are living beings, not only the Earth, but all the planets. And they make up the chakras of the living cosmic God, which is our cosmos, with the sun at its head. And the masters of wisdom must take them and their energies and their relationships, the drama between the planets, into account when they're planning for the evolutionary impulses, the acceleration of humanity's trajectory. And when you think about what's happening now, all the violence, and you think about Uranus bearing down on Taurus, the earth, the agriculture, the food structures, and also just how it comes in as a lightning bolt, as a, you know, very violent kind of energy, just Shiva, destructive, allowing for something new, the destroying of old forms. And it's going into Gemini. How, even though we're very, many of us are very frightened or suffering ill health or whatever, we can see that the old forms that are already defunct and no longer working are going to continue to be destroyed because they no longer are worthy of humanity and humanity's development. And so I just wanted to say that when those of us who study astrology, not only the Western, but the Vedic and even the Chinese, we learn a great deal. And it can be also very reassuring that when difficulties happen in our personal life, that they are actually impersonal ground forces, invisible in nature, bearing down on all of us. And yes, those of us who are more evolved or who have more tutelage or maybe teachers, direct relationships, we're privileged to know this knowledge. And we have better choices to make if we choose to use them, if we choose to understand that there's something for us distinctively to do, which is different from those people who are suffering, really, without any solace, because they don't have the reassurances of the knowledge that we have. For instance, for example, even that the masters of wisdom are working behind the scenes.
Yeah, well said, Ariane. I'll just address what your initial statement about, you know, that the masters of wisdom must certainly know about the the potency of the other planetary logi. And I would add to that the idea that these planetary schemes outside our Earth scheme have their own humanities. They have their own groups of masters of wisdom. DK tells us very directly that this is the case. And so they are, once an initiate becomes a planetary citizen, which happens at the fourth initiation, and you relocate your consciousness onto the Buddhic plane, this whole world of solar systemic awareness opens, and your line of influence becomes solar systemic, and also those who you work with are from all the planets according to the nature of your ray makeup, and the Kumaras themselves, the seven Kumaras. Well, we have Sanat Kumara, who is our planetary logos. The other six are emissaries from the other planets. They're great beings who are representatives of those other planetary logos. So as we move beyond personality confines, we come into this greater world and the influence of it. Thank you for that, Ariane. Yes, more hands?
Yes, Joe, please go ahead.
It just occurred to me that the work with the medicine wheel is equal and takes us down into the lower kingdoms, whereas right now we're discussing the sky itself and higher kingdoms.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, there is an interesting reversal there between
It's
the.
plants, animals, and minerals.
Yeah, and I did a little. I studied for a while with an Apache shaman, and what I found is that it's really the great Devic beings who overshadow these different animals. And less so the plants and minerals, but for instance, if you have a totem of a particular animal, then you have been blessed with the ability to contact that great Devic being who overshadows this particular animal, and you have access to all the attributes. You, in a sense, become a student of this greater being who overshadows, the animal. It's not the animal itself. The animal is the expression of these greater beings. Thanks, Joe. Anyone else? All right. So next up. Make sure I didn't read now. The Central and North American Indians also had an understanding of the zodiac, but the patterns and numbers of the signs differed in many details from those of the Eastern Hemisphere. So the foundation of Mayan astrology is the Tzolk'in. It's Tzolk'in, a 260-day calendar that combines 20-day signs with 13 galactic numbers. There's that number 13 again. This creates a cycle of 260 unique days through the combination of the 13 and the 20, each with its own astrological meaning. In addition to the day signs and galactic numbers, there are nine lords of the night, each governing a night in a cycle. These deities are thought to influence the energies of the nights they rule. The Native American zodiac consists of 12 signs, each associated with a different animal. We were just talking about this, a different animal totem that represents the characteristics and life missions of individuals born under those animals. These signs are further conditioned by one of four directional winds. Each animal totem embodies unique characteristics. For example, the otter, January 20th to February 18th, which is under the influence of the north wind, is known for its creativity and non-conformity, akin to the Aquarius sign in Western astrology. Next. The word zodiac is derived from the Greek zodiacos, which means a circle of animals, or as some believe, little animals. It is name given by the old pagan astronomers to a band of fixed stars about 16 degrees wide, apparently encircling the Earth. Eight of the signs are associated with animals. While Gemini, Virgo, and Aquarius are human, and the symbol for Libra is the scales, the zodiac is divided into 12 30-degree segments. Though, as you can see, some zodiacal constellations are much larger than others. They are arrayed along the ecliptic, a band of stars which, as MPH points out, is about 16 degrees wide. And finally, Robert Hewitt Brown, 32nd degree Mason, states that the Greek word zodiacos comes from zoon, meaning an animal. He adds, the latter word is compounded directly from the primitive Egyptian radicals zo, life, and on, a being. This statement is from Stellar Theology and Masonic Astronomy. It's a beautiful book, written by Brown in 1882. According to contemporary reviews, the book was well-researched and beautifully written, revealing the hidden meaning behind Masonic and other symbols. Quote, the work delves into the interpretation of celestial symbols and their influence on the history of human civilization, focusing on the symbolism of the sun and its journey through the zodiac. It discusses how ancient astronomical systems were incorporated into religious concepts and belief systems, forming the basis for many of today's religious ideas. Sounds like a good read. You know, there were a lot of incredible books written in the 1880s. Probably at the top of the list would be The Secret Doctrine, but there were many, many extraordinarily esoteric books that came out around that time. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please? Yeah?
Sorry, Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. The Greeks and later other peoples influenced by their culture divided the band of the zodiac into 12 sections, each being 16 degrees in width and 30 degrees in length. These divisions were called the houses of the zodiac. The sun, during its annual pilgrimage, passed through each of these in turn. Imaginary creatures were traced in the star groups bounded by these rectangles. And because most of them were animal or part animal in form, they later became known as the constellations or signs of the zodiac. There is a popular theory concerning the origin of the zodiacal creatures to the effect that they were products of the imagination of shepherds who, watching their flocks at night, occupied their minds by tracing the forms of animals and birds in the heavens. This theory is untenable unless the shepherds, quoted, be regarded as the shepherd priests of antiquity. It is unlikely that the zodiacal signs were derived from the star groups which they now represent. It is far more probable that the creatures assigned to the 12 houses are symbolic of the qualities and intensity of the sun's power while it occupies different parts of the zodiacal belt.
Thank you. Okay, first. The Greeks and later other peoples influenced by their culture divided the band of the zodiac into 12 sections, each being 16 degrees in width and 30 degrees in length. These divisions were called the houses of the zodiac. The sun, during its annual pilgrimage, passed through each of these in turn. Imaginary creatures were traced in the star groups bounded by these rectangles. And because most of them were animal or part animal in form, they later became known as the constellations or signs of the zodiac. So let's take a minute to take a mini tour of the signs. This is with a focus on the stars that are in each sign, not so much of the meaning, because you could write, you know, you could do 10 webinars on each sign. So this is just the briefest of tours to begin to get us acquainted with this sign. So we'll start with Aries, which sits right on the ecliptic, as most of them do, though some of them are a little bit off, and whose brightest star is Hamal. You can see the ecliptic here, going right through the sign of Aries. Next up is Taurus, which stands above. There's Hamal, by the way. So next up is Taurus, which stands above Orion, you can see, and includes the Pleiades, said by DK to be the source of the third aspect of our solar system. And Aldebaran, the 14th brightest star in the night sky, of which DK says, the eye of the bull in Taurus, the magnificent fixed star Aldebaran, is one of the reasons why the constellation is regarded as conferring illumination. In ancient days, it was called the leading star of the heavens, and Taurus has always been connected with light, and therefore with Christ, who proclaimed himself as the light of the world. As you can see by the map, we are moving counterclockwise around the zodiac, around the ecliptic. Next up, Gemini, which is made up of the twins Castor and Pollux. HPB says, actually, let's get a reader for this.
Read it. The legend of Castor and Pollux is concerned with the mortal half of man, the personality, and the immortal part, the ego or spiritual individual. The personality has nothing in itself to survive, and the other half, which becomes immortal in its individuality by reason of its fifth principle, being called to life by the informing gods, thus connecting the monad with this earth. This is Pollux, while Castor represents the personal, mortal man, an animal of not even a superior kind. When unlinked from the divine individuality, Pollux sacrifices himself to Castor.
Thank you, BL. Okay, I see a hand.
Yes. Marianne, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to this this idea about Gemini and the twins, about, and it relates even to the two fish in Pisces. This idea of this two, the soul and the personality in battle or struggling, but it also is this idea that is through one's evolutionary journey going to go beyond duality. So one of the chief challenges for all of us is not to be caught up in the good and the bad, just to detach and still stay in relationship to the duality, not to deny that it exists, but to go beyond it to this third position of the observer. And I think that Gemini is, that's one of the symbols of the twins, is to go beyond duality.
Yeah, it's well said. You know, the fourth creative hierarchy, which is a liberated hierarchy, is ruled by Gemini. And its description is the source of duality, right? So that's, and instead of battling, I like to think of it as the effort to articulate duality and align with the higher over time courses. struggle continues in Virgo as well. And as you say, in Pisces is another description of this particular type of duality in the band that links the two fishes. Yeah, we could say much more, couldn't we? But that's good for now. This is just a brief little quick tour and with a focus mostly on the stars. So next up, Cancer, the dimmest of the zodiacal constellations, whose name is Latin for crab. At the center of this constellation stands M44, the beehive cluster, you see it here. Also called the manger, which some believe to have been conjunct Jupiter at the time of the birth of Jesus. We next have Leo. This is the manger, by the way. Next we have Leo, which has 9 bright stars that can be easily seen with the naked eye, with 4 of the 9 either first or second magnitude. About Leo's brightest star, DK says, the influence of Sirius, 3 in number, are focused in Regulus, which is, as you know, a star of the first magnitude, and which is frequently called the heart of the lion. There's more real occultism hidden in the names given to the various stars by astronomers down the ages than has yet been realized. And here you have a case in point. Next up, Virgo, the largest of the 12 zodiacal constellations and the second largest constellation in the sky after the Hydra. AAB says, well, actually, let's get a reader for this.
Okay. Rudy, can you read that for us, please?
It is interesting also to note that the brightest and largest star in the constellation Virgo is called Spica. It is to be found in the ear of corn, in brackets, sign of fertility, which the Virgin holds. Bethlehem means the house of bread, and there is therefore an obvious connection between those two words. This constellation is also composed of 3 stars.
Oops. Okay, those are the 3 stars, but let's get back here.
In the shape of a cup. This is the true holy grail, that which contains the lifeblood, the repository of the sacred and the holy, and that which conceals divinity.
So, you know, the virgin, so-called the virgin mother figure is herself a cup which holds, you know, the is a sacred repository of the holy, right? But you also have within this same constellation these 3 stars, Porima, Zenaya, and Vindimeatrix, which form what's called the Holy Grail. Next slide, Libra is one of the dimmer constellations and is the only sign whose symbol is neither an animal nor a human being. Alpha and Beta Libra are considered to represent the scales balance beam, while Gamma and Sigma represent the weighing pans. Though of an unassuming appearance, Libra is extremely significant in esoteric astrology, as it is during the Jiva's sojourn in this sign that his or her direction on the wheel of life is determined. By the way, the way they An alternate name for any of the named stars is the brightest star is called the name of the sign plus alpha. So you have Alpha Libra would be the name of the brightest star in Libra. Alpha Leo would be the name of Regulus, for instance. And so, and then Beta and down the line. Libra is followed by Scorpio, home of the red star Antares, about which Alice Bailey says, at the heart of Scorpio, we find Antares, one of the four royal stars, a red star. Red is the color of desire. And this is the reddest star in the heavens. It symbolizes that red of desire that underlies every manifestation of divine life. This sixth ray theme of desire is carried forward by Mars, Scorpio's exoteric and esoteric ruler. Next up, Sagittarius, home of the Milky Way's galactic center, a supermassive black hole of about 4 million solar masses called Sagittarius A. Interestingly, Sagittarius's arrow points directly towards Antares. Continuing counterclockwise around the ecliptic, we come to Capricorn, the sea goat. DK says, the symbol for the sign Capricorn is most mysterious. It conceals the mystery of the crocodiles or Makara. It is constructed in an inaccurate and definitely misleading manner and should be regarded as a mystery and therefore not to be defined. I think somewhere else he says that if someone were to correctly intuit the way the sign is to be symbolically drawn, that it would open up a floodgate of energy that humanity is not ready for. So it's definitely one of those secrets of initiation. Next, we have Aquarius, the water carrier, who represents Enki, the Sumerian god of creation, water, and intelligence. Aquarius, sign of the world server, is uniquely important right now because we are moving towards that 2160-year period called the Aquarian Age. In fact, we're well into the cusp of the New Age. And finally, we come to Pisces, one of the larger constellations, but with no particular bright stars. Nevertheless, its symbol, two fishes joined by a band, has been recognized since ancient times. It's also considered one of the two earliest of the signs, and that it was known in the previous solar system, according to DK. So that's our little mini tour. Of course, we'll be saying much, much more about these signs as we continue with the text, but just to get some visuals and to have especially the star relationships, you know, where the important stars are along the ecliptic. I saw a hand.
Ariane, please go ahead.
Yeah, just to discuss briefly Alice Bailey's summation of Capricorn, because again, I think it's extremely practical for us to look at the image and think about it in terms of our own spiritual work. So it's the mountain goat going up the mountain, and these mountain goats, if anyone's seen one, they are on the teeniest ledges of this mountain, the mountain symbolizing the material aspect of Earth, the, you know, matter aspect, and also the fact that we get caught up in matter and need to ascend towards the heavenly spheres. And the goat is showing us just that it risks all by ascending, you know, it goes to the
realms where there's little oxygen, little food. And it's the symbol for us not to be trapped in the material of our lives. And so I just wanted to share that. I hope it's of some use.
Yeah, thank you, Arya. So, you know, DK talks a lot about the sheep and the goats. And the goats in that reference are those who are coming into mental focus. Or we have a double Saturn rulership in Capricorn. And are therefore finding their way onto what you might call rocky terrain, right? Where they're more at home. Whereas the sheep represents the personality in this context. You know, there are other references. And then the other thing I would say about this is that the other animal associated with Capricorn is the unicorn, and that represents one who's has synthesized duality into the monadic understanding, and is guided, therefore truly guided by the monad, and that's represented by the one horn of the unicorn. I saw a hand.
Yes, Trudy, please go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder about the fishy tail. Well, what does that mean? I'm Capricorn myself, so I don't know much about this.
Okay, BL, it's your turn.
Well, that is the representation of the sea goat.
Right, but why is it a sea goat? What's the deal there?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what the representation of the sea goat is, but it's just another aspect of the Capricorn.
Right.
And you know, it could be the rising from the sea up through and then becoming the goat that scales the mountaintop and then becoming the unicorn. You know, just some kind of other representation, but other than the fact that that represents a sea goat, I'm not sure how that otherwise fits in.
Yeah. I think also that it could indicate the cosmic astral plane, that, you know, the source of the symbol, in fact, the source of the Makara are cosmic astral in their nature. And of course, that also is the waters. That's where the waters of life are. So, but I like what you said too, which is it's sort of like the whole journey in one image, which is that, you know, you come up out of the Cancerian seas and to its opposite sign, you know, Cancer moving to Capricorn. So you have the gate into the human kingdom, which is very watery, and then you have the gate out of the human kingdom, which is at the top of the mountain. Joe, you want to say something?
Yeah, hold on just one second, Joe, okay?
Sure.
I did just look it up, and it suggests that the combination of earth and water, because it's both grounded and practical, is sensitive and creative. The sea goat is a mythological creature that Capricorn's dual nature, to be both grounded and practical as well as sensitive and creative. And that actually ties in the sensitivity of Cancer and the Cancer Capricorn axis. But okay, go ahead, please, Joe.
I'm thinking about the, good Lord, the Libra being the fourth part of this particular cross. And it relates to Draco, the serpent. But I have a question. And that is, did the Egyptians have anything to do with crocodiles?
Yeah, it was one of Sobeth. It was one of their gods. And you know, it was associated with the Nile, with wisdom, with the unknown, with mystery. I would think very much like that, you know, esoterically, they were quite aware of the Makara, and it would have been a connection with that.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. And there's certainly more to that story, but that's, you know, off the top of my head. You know, the crocodile and the dragon and the serpent are all very related in ancient mythology. You see it a lot. Okay, you all, that's we're out of time, so we'll pick up back to the text next time. So we have a correction. I think the is it the second or the fourth? I'm sorry. Is it the Treatise Cosmic Fire that's coming up this Friday that's said to be at 8 o'clock, or the one after that?
Both of them are listed on the calendar itself. You know, you click on the Moira Federation calendar as 8 o'clock.
That's not correct.
That isn't correct. The time is 7 o'clock, and the actual announcement on the homepage say 7 o'clock, and so that's the correct one. And we'll try and get the calendar fixed for that.
Okay,
and that's the 12th.
Let me interject. Go ahead.
Okay, no, go ahead. You finish.
I'm just going to say, every one of these webinars starts at 7 o'clock. There are no exceptions. All right. Now, in the winter, the time shifts. The local time stays the same, but the time shifts in the winter. But all through after the equinox, after the time change, daylight savings time changes, it always is at 7 o'clock. And then I think it's always at 8 o'clock during the winter. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So, you know, if you're clicking on a link, don't be fooled if something is off like that. All of these started, and it's every one of the webinars starts at the same time. So go ahead with what you were going to say.
Okay. Every one of the webinars that Francis does.
There's
a different time for the one that Dwayne does. But anyway, we have announcements out for all of them, except we don't do a typical announcement like we do with Secret Doctrine and STOA for the Treatise on Cosmic Fire, because that is on the calendar and it has an announcement on the Moira Federation homepage. Okay, so the next TCF is this coming Friday, the 12th of July. The next Secret Doctrine will be the 21st of July. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be the 4th of August.
There you have it.
So we hope to see you all then.
Yes, thank you all for attending. We'll see you next time. I'm going to look at the chats here. And great. Thank you. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Goodbye.